This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. In Digital Islamophobia, Tracking a Far-Right Crisis, published by De Gruyter in 2023, Emily Linnell Edwards explores this virtual and vicious threat, analyzing how these global networks grow, develop, and circulate Islamophobic hate speech on Twitter. Emily Edwards is an assistant professor of digital humanities and educational technologist at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, New York. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
So let's get started. Could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Absolutely. So I come from an American culture studies background. That's what my PhD was in. And this project really started there. I was really interested in learning how to use critical data analytic tools to answer traditional humanities research questions. So for me, I was very interested in topics of hate speech, online communities, but really looking at the threats and the experiences of Muslim communities online. So that is sort of the genesis of the project. And I became interested in using data tools such as Twitter's API, data visualization software such as Gephi, to really visualize these communities and networks and say, we know that this is a social crisis, rising hate speech targeting Muslim communities, but how could we visualize this? How could we track this? And how could we really look at these experiences from a humanities perspective? So this really is a digital humanities project that tries to use these data analytic tools to understand a particular moment in time in digital history. Having lived in Germany and done studies and some fieldwork interviewing refugees and asylum seekers post-Syrian refugee crisis, this was a topic that was really important to me and close to my heart. And so the project kind of came together from there, from that background as a researcher doing interviews, and then that experience, my technical expertise to really pursue this, that sort of led to the book it is today.
Right. Very interesting. And you look especially at the Islamophobic discourse on Twitter, what used to be called Twitter. I don't know how people are referring to it these days. What are the unique features of Twitter that allow for the creation of networked public spheres you find so interesting?
That is a great question. Twitter, I think sometimes we're calling it X these days. I feel like it's always, something else with Elon Musk. But I was really interested in Twitter, as you said, because this is really a mainstream public sphere. Sort of before this book, looking back at social movements like the Arab Spring, hashtag Black Lives Matter, Twitter is really the locus of, or has been the locus of, mainstream political conversation and digital activism online. So I was really interested in taking Twitter as kind of the jumping off point to then look and see, how are these far-right networks developing right in front of our eyes, right? Using hashtags and apps. But looking specifically at far-right extremist speech versus maybe some of these progressive pro-democratic social movements that other scholars have examined. And with this book, you know, I really found that Twitter is sort of the tip of the iceberg in many ways. This is really where a lot of everyday casual users get exposed to misinformation, extremist hate speech, conspiracy theories, this anti-Muslim content that then eventually radicalizes them and leads them to what we could call darker or more niche corners of the internet, whether that is fringe digital news sites or that, you know, spaces such as 4chan, for example, that Twitter was really the kind of battleground in many ways where progressive and reactionary collectives and communities, you know, wage discursive war over some of these topics. And for far-right actors, particularly anti-Muslim communities, in Germany, the United States, but also India and Nigeria, Twitter has really been a place to engage in these sort of global conversations and to make these sort of transnational far-right connections, which I think are particularly troubling, especially, you know, as we've seen with Elon Musk's enhancing and loosening some of these content moderation rules that allow these collectives to, you know, to engage in more extremist content production.
Right. Once Musk purchased Twitter.
Absolutely. Yes. This was occurred in the when I was still writing the book, actually. So chapter five was a big revision. I felt like I was rewriting that almost every single week. He was doing something new. So that was an interesting writing experience. But I would say that, you know, over the course of this book, that all of the problems that Twitter presents, they're not just coming from Elon Musk, that we can look back at earlier sort of traditions of content moderation on the platform and see that there are some really serious issues to the way in which Twitter is, you know, disciplining or not disciplining and dealing with hate speech and particularly anti-Muslim hate content that, you know, we would probably classify this as hate speech, violent, extremist content, but doesn't necessarily violate the terms of service. So this problem, I think, really predates Elon Musk, but he has definitely, with his leadership style and new policies that he's enacted, has really, you know, made Twitter a much more toxic platform.
Right. And so you mentioned that, you know, your book is centered very much in the Twitter space in America and also in Germany, but that you also look at Nigeria and India. And I'm curious, sort of, how did you choose those particular four countries? You know, is it that those countries are uniquely the Twitter sort of profile or whatever discourse in those four countries is uniquely Islamophobic, or were there other reasons for choosing those four to look at?
For this project, initially, I was really interested in looking primarily at Germany and the United States, but following a grounded theory methodology, which I think has been extremely helpful for looking at digital culture and digital activism, Nigeria and India really surfaced as key topics to look at in the data. And so I really found or sort of uncovered through looking at these, you know, traces left behind from users that there's actually a very strong American Indian anti-Muslim network online. And I think that that connection really comes from some overlap that we can see between far-right Hindu nationalist extremist movements that have been developing in the nation of India and the overlap there to I would call, you know, the Trump MAGA movement and the overlap between Trump and Modi, the connections there.
And Modi, also the Prime Minister of India.
Yes, yeah, the BJP party. So when we look at the Twitter culture in India, there's a very strong far-right Hindu nationalist, you know, almost troll army that some scholars have explored. And they're sort of finding a lot of common cause with white American users who were also interested in circulating Muslim hate speech. The Nigerian case is very interesting. And that really surfaced in looking at the activities of the pro-Biafran separatist organizations and activists who were really looking at, connecting with far-right American users and MAGA supporters in the United States to really critique what they were seeing as the Muslim Fulani ethnic religious dominance in Nigeria with the predominantly Igbo-Biafran collectives and activists on Twitter are predominantly Christian. And so the Nigerian case, there was some interesting instrumentalization of, I would call, homegrown American Islamophobia being sort of turned around and instrumentalized by these pro-Biafran activists to connect back to Trump and other MAGA celebrities to draw attention to native ethnic and religious conflicts in Nigeria. So I would say that while these, types of extremist cultures are not necessarily native or natural to any nation, Twitter has kind of provided, a platform space for these groups, which are very nationally focused, to start making some of these transnational connections in ways that we really haven't seen in earlier media eras, social network dominance.
Right. Very, very interesting. And your book focuses on, unquote, far right users on social media. Just before we get too much deeper, what exactly does that label refer to?
So this is a really interesting question, one that I was really thinking a lot about when I was writing the book is how do we classify and categorize users along an ideological continuum? And so for me, looking at the far right, this really means looking at users, communities, and outlets that are beyond social conservatism, that this is not mainstream ideology, but that racial or ethnic nationalism is a core part, whether that is a belief in ethnic German nationalism, whether that is a version of extremist far-right Hindu nationalism, white Christian nationalism in the United States, that it's that racial ethnic component that I think that we can look at and classify that as particularly extreme. And it manifests in, nationally specific ways in the United States, in Germany, in India, for example. But it's that racial ethnic component that I think is very central.
Right. And could you describe for us the profile of far right Islamophobic transnational Twitter users? I mean, who are they?
Certainly. This was one of my core questions I was really interested in exploring in the book was the content of these conversations. What's the content? And then what are the contours of these community networks? And who is really involved in circulating this type of hate speech and extremist content? In doing data scraping and data visualization, I was able to develop a taxonomy or a typography of different users. And I myself was really surprised by how sort of mundane and everyday and average some of these users were. Of course, in some cases, you could find really, politically extreme users. I classify some as, white supremacist nationalists or German transnational Trumpists. But often I think that the most dangerous users were users that I call the neighborly racists. This, is someone who, describes themselves as, an everyday average voter, a suburban mom or, a grandpa. But they're engaging with really virulent racist content online. And so it was these users who were retweeting, engaging, producing this anti-Muslim hate speech that I was most troubled by and that I think, more attention needs to be on these types of users, that these far-right extremist networks, they're not all run and constructed by politicians, news outlets, or large influencers, but it's everyday average social media users who are really mainstreaming this type of language circulating some of this type of content. So I would say there's a continuum of extremism. At the end are these very politically extremist users. And then at the other end, are these sort of neighborly racists, average everyday folks who might not classify themselves as Islamophobic, but are buying into this type of ideology.
All right. And I'm just curious, like, is there a way to know kind of for sure who, you know, how accurate or honest are people's, you know, portrayals of themselves? In other words, someone says, oh, I'm just a you know, regular Joe, you know, whatever. To what extent could we feel secure that that's really sort of representative of who they are, as opposed to just a kind of front or something for a more formal, organized effort at, you know, hate speech?
Certainly. That is, I think, a really, that's a key issue in looking at this type of content. For me, as a sort of a mixed methods type of project, I was really interested in kind of taking a lot of these descriptions, biographies, often at face value, you know, because even if we are not doing direct interviews with many of these users, which is, you know, can be challenging, certainly as a, you know, a type of academic inquiry, what they are presenting online is what other users are engaging with, that this is a production and an expression of online identity. And so, you know, as a feminist researcher who has done digital ethnography, but also has done, you know, field work and interviews with folks, you know, taking these descriptions and this content as authentic productions of some type of narrative that the user is trying to produce, even if, you know, we might not be able to fully verify. But I will say that Twitter's API using that certainly has been helpful. And so looking at some of the, you know, the language that users choose to, you know, register with or their reported locations, and then really kind of looking at the other type of content that they produce, that was one way that I tried to get a sense of who really are these people behind the individual tweet. So certainly not a perfect verification method, but getting really a sense of the lay of the land in that way.
Right, right. And I'm wondering, to what extent are these far-right users creating locally specific nationalist ideologies? And to what extent are they simply reappropriating each other's hateful rhetoric for their own ethno-nationalist purposes?
Certainly. This interesting transmutation of local and global issues was something that I was really tracking in the American and also in the German context, that over the course of the project, for example, seeing the way in which users would recirculate conspiracy theories related to masking during the height of the pandemic, you know, suggesting that mask mandates in Germany or the United States were sort of a pretext to force, you know, veiling upon society and to Islamicize the German and American public, I think is a really good example of, in one case, a sort of traditionally, well, not traditional, but an American kind of ethos of this, you know, pushing against pandemic restrictions, pushing against masking, that then became very much circulated within German networks. This notion that masking is connected to veiling, which is connected to these larger and more historic German debates about, you know, various, you know, individuals wearing the hijab in public. So I think that's an interesting example of where we see perhaps quite a locally specific issue in the case of masking in the United States then becomes recirculated, remixed on Twitter to then tap into maybe these historic German anxieties surrounding the public display of Muslim religiosity, you know, in German public spaces. And Twitter as a platform really facilitates that disembedding of local issues and then remixing them into another national context, even if it might not necessarily be based in fact or might not necessarily have a clear kind of historic connection. But Twitter really facilitates this disembedding and remixing.
How do they facilitate that?
So I think through the affordances, certainly of the retweeting and the adding, just the very basic functionalities of the platform that I think we're all very used to, perhaps as social media users. But Twitter, because of the sort of loose content moderation policies, and I think the turn away from fact checking in particular, it's turn away from community notes. There's been some back and forth about that, really allows bad actors to take, individual news stories or pictures, pieces of content that by themselves may be innocuous or even true, and then reframe them with inaccurate, misleading misinformation that then go viral and can eventually over time radicalize users. And so while, those are the affordances that are built into Twitter, I think that, there has to potentially be a different way to address or put some guardrails on this type of user-generated content because we're seeing a really kind of extremist application of some of these affordances.
Right. And you have a case study of how Indian users produce Islamophobic content that resonates with white American users. Could you tell us about that?
Certainly. So Indian far-right Hindu nationalist users were incredibly prolific at producing content on Twitter and also circulating content to white American far-right or right-wing audiences. Over the course of this project, when I was collecting my data, this was also the height of protest and discussion in India around two policy initiatives, the Citizenship Amendment Act and the National Registry of Citizens in India, which are two policy amendments that effectively function to exclude and disenfranchise Muslim Indians from their citizenship rights. So while this conversation is happening in India, we start to see a lot of far-right Hindu nationalist activists on India posting a lot of content about the CAA and NRC, a lot of misleading demographic statistics, other misinformation, but producing this content in a way that really resonated with an American audience. And in doing so, to really draw attention to the pro-CIA NRC position. These stories, that are sort of circulated using different statistics, talking about changing demographic rates, these are scare tactics that work for Indian users, but also really resonated with white far-right users who may have been amenable to former President Trump's policies, such as the Muslim ban, who may be amenable to arguments about immigration, and then we're consuming this content, seeing, what is happening over in India could happen in the United States. And so Twitter really collapses distance in an interesting way to then make those, seemingly nationally specific policy discussions in India relevant then to white American audiences who become primed and concerned and then engaged with, even more anti-Muslim content. And far-right white American micro-influencers are also very adept at connecting with other transnational networks. And so we can see, through that line of far-right Hindu nationalist Indian actors producing this content, micro-influencers who are tapped into this network, then are, recirculating this content to then the everyday average user. So in that way, we can look at Twitter really certainly as a network, but also as a pipeline where content is produced in one sort of national enclave, and then it moves across the platform to then reach a different audience.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was really fascinated by that case study because, it seems to me one of the kind of key features of sort of extremist white nationalist, Christian white nationalist in America is racism. And, you know, it's very a deep kind of hatred and condescension towards people of color and so on. And I just found it fascinating that within this world, they were able to sort of make space for racism or prejudice that was produced by people of color in a different continent.
Yes, that is, I think, one point that I think is really critical for us to think about as researchers of far-right extremism, as citizens, is that these movements, they may be seemingly very nationally focused or racially homogenous, but far-right extremism, this is a flexible ideology. And these communities and activists will look for partners to further their agenda. And so I think in the case of, white American Christian nationalists, they find a lot of common cause with Indian far right, Hindu nationalist collectives and groups that they are working together in some ways to really push racially, ethnically homogenous, religiously homogenous, and specifically anti-Muslim vision of society. I think these network connections that we're seeing, they're quite troubling. It's not helpful for us to think about these groups in national silos, that these are transnational issues, these are platformed issues. And so how do we address then, the case in the United States? Well, we also have to think about, connections, right? And the extremism that's happening in India.
Right, right. And you have another case study of how German far-right actors manipulate news stories to spread misinformation about Muslim religious sites. Could you tell us about that?
Certainly. Within the German sort of Twitter sphere, we could say, while it may be more sort of nationally oriented, we can see, different sort of far-right activists take up local issues in an interesting way to then make them nationally applicable. So one trend that I really found interesting and concerning was the way in which certain users would sort of recirculate information about mosques, whether that was religious activities at mosques and also religious restrictions or exemptions that were occurring during the pandemic. And so a lot of content circulated around the mosque in Duisburg in Germany. And so far-right activists taking, in some cases, old footage or even footage directly from members of the mosque and recirculating it with this sort of conspiratorial framing or misinformation that on first glance, if you are an average everyday user, it might be hard to decode and understand that is misinformation. It's not correct. And this is also not just undertaken by individual users, but also fringe digital news sites such as Journalist and Watch or Anonymous News. Those were also really key players within the German Twitter network for producing at a fast clip, many news stories, which I would hesitate to even call news because these don't really meet, traditional journalistic production standards. But these stories and content that, really racialized, excluded other Muslim communities and engaged in fear mongering and then circulated this across the German Twitter network. And so this kind of overlap between individual users in the German context who were reframing, circulating dubious information, and then the activities of fringe news sites for us, I think we could, consider Breitbart, an American example, or producing this content that really resonates then with the everyday kind of average German user who then becomes, perhaps inoculated to consuming even more extreme content.
Right. And how do the case studies of the Indian and German hate speech reveal the tensions between Twitter's public stance against hate speech and its content moderation policies?
The content moderation is a really key area of concern. I think all of the cases that I've presented, often they did not violate Twitter's hateful conduct policy in many cases, which we might find surprising. But the way in which companies engage in content moderation, I argue it's really not designed to protect users or to make platforms safer spaces, but it's designed to ally dealing with some of these messy questions and to protect the platform itself to attain a kind of basic level of acceptability so advertisers aren't driven away. So in many cases, the content moderation that's enacted by Twitter, even before Elon Musk's takeover of the platform, it really was, limited in many ways. And we can look back to earlier incidences such as the hashtag Gamergate movement, I think is a really classic example, or, different instances of high profile racial harassment targeting celebrities, such as the abuse that was circulated during the female Ghostbusters reboot on Twitter is another example. Where Twitter was just not interested in moderating or dealing with extremist racist hate speech, and we're seeing that really continue. The problem here that I really think about, though, is this is often targeting also average, everyday, Muslim communities who do not have the resources of, celebrities, politicians, right, or institutions to push back against this speech. But that this is a torrent of content that Twitter just really allied dealing with. And with Elon Musk's takeover of the platform, his emphasis on free speech absolutism, I think has really trended towards even more extreme content. And so Twitter does have some pressures. The Digital Services Act, it has to comply with. And there are nationally specific laws and policies. So the NetzDG in Germany is one example where Germany mandates a different type of moderation of speech than in the United States, for example. But as we've seen with Musk's leadership, that Twitter is kind of struggling in many ways to kind of comply with some of these basic laws and regulations. So I think it will be, it's sort of an open question, I think, right now, how the company will choose to respond and how it may be compelled to respond to some of this type of content.
Right. And how do far-right, white American Christian, Islamophobic hate influence anti-Muslim, Nigerian, and Indian national politics?
Certainly. I think we're really seeing, again, it's more disturbing developments in this space. I think that looking back when this research was conducted, kind of considering the American foreign policy and how it supported Prime Minister Modi's more nationalist, Hindu nationalist policies is a huge concern. And looking at the Nigerian case in particular, we're really seeing these pro-Biafran activists, separatist activists, were really looking to connect with, at the time, members of the Trump administration and Republican politicians to raise awareness of and attention to these local and national ethnic conflicts in the Nigerian state. I think that in both of these cases, in India and Nigeria, the goal here is to raise awareness and to build these coalitions with white Christian, evangelical, in many cases, fundamentalist users and communities so that then policies can be created, foreign policies can be created that support these type of then local nationalist movements in India and Nigeria. And that's another point that I think is really critical, is that while a lot of this is talking about digital discourse and hate speech on Twitter, is that the goal is then to produce coalitions and to produce these national networks that then drive policy, that drive laws. And we've seen, I think, the Muslim ban in the United States, and then the CIA, NRC in India as examples of what happens at the end of the line. Then where does, you know, discourse and ideology move into directing policy?
Yeah, that was actually my next question, which is that your book understandably is focusing on one, you know, sector, on, you know, on Twitter and more generally on, you know, social media. But there's obviously a concern, a fear that this discourse is then translated into action on the ground and impacting, you know, the lives of people in society in general. And yeah, it sounds like that's something that's already underway.
Definitely. And just adding on to that, I think another concern I have is, you know, looking ahead to the 2025 federal German election and the 2024 American presidential election, you know, is how does this type of discourse influence not just policy, but individual political activity and activism? And that, you know, we're seeing instances of sort of spontaneous, you know, terrorism and political violence in Germany and in the United States. And so, you know, while I, you know, can't draw a direct line between a, you know, a post that is certainly anti-Muslim hate speech and then an extremist attack, or murder, I think that as researchers, as policymakers, we need to start taking seriously the connection between extremist online rhetoric and then policy and also political violence that we're seeing. And so I hope that in looking at this one sort of area of, you know, the far right online, is not to be exhaustive, but it's to document this period of digital history, to identify that this is happening, to understand the communities and the networks of transmission, so that perhaps we can take some steps to address this, whether that is through citizen advocacy or whether that is through enacting new policies, regulations, or laws to really moderate on a comprehensive level these online spaces, which are now the digital public sphere, the town square where these conversations are happening.
Right. And in the German context, what role do fringe media sites play in recirculating Islamophobic content?
These German fringe news sites, they play a very large role in sort of circulating and transmitting, and I think definitely mainstreaming and making this type of content seem factual, verifiable, to users who are now, they're in a fragmented media environment where the dominance of legacy media outlets, you know, is being shaken. And so we're starting to see the kind of, you know, the rise up of some of these fringe sites. And they produce actually, in the German case, a lot of the content that is circulated, not all of the content that I discuss in the German case or in the book more broadly, always necessarily originates from Twitter, but Twitter is the stage. That's where it gets presented. So Journalist and Watch is one outlet in particular that they have a whole section devoted towards covering Islam in Germany and writing Islamophobic stories. And then they use Twitter as a place to circulate and gain an audience. So Twitter really is sort of the stage where some of these fringe news sites, you know, you may be a user and you never go to anonymousnews.net, but you may come across one of their stories on your feed, and then you would follow, right, them and then more suggested users. And then this is really how the path to radicalization starts. So these fringe news sites, they use Twitter as the place to present and circulate their content. And so that was really an emphasis in the book as well, is to take Twitter as that initial point of examination and then see, well, what are the sort of satellite sites and areas that are sort of associated with it? So these fringe news sites are key. Increasingly, they're using applications such as Telegram, so or their private encrypted messaging channels to present their content to a new audience, given Twitter's sort of current challenges, I would say, over the last couple of months.
Right. And you touched on this before, but what does the case of Germany tell us about opportunities for policy interventions to address anti-Muslim hate speech on Twitter?
I think that even with some of the limitations of nationally specific regulation and law, I think that Germany provides perhaps a template that we could replicate in the United States. So when we look at platforms like Twitter, Facebook, many of these platforms sort of operate under this American ethos of a Wild West model of free speech, that any and all content, you know, as long as it's not illegal, can be platformed and circulated. But in Germany, if we look at Germany's sort of post-war laws governing speech and expression, that they take a very different approach. For example, limits, Holocaust denial, for example, or the expression of Nazi symbols. And so this is then carried over into the operation of these platforms, that Twitter must comply with some of these laws. Facebook must comply. And so I think that, this is a good example of a nation coming together and deciding these are basic fundamental social norms around speech, that some things tip into extremist speech, hate speech, and are not allowed. While the application of some of these laws has not always been, great, at least there's a framework in Germany. And so I think that, this could be a template in Germany. It's the also the NetzDG as another nationally specific sort of policy framework that governs misinformation, privacy, et cetera, that we could look and consider implementing something like that in the United States. But I will say that even though Germany has offered us an interesting template, I think this also requires looking at the platforms themselves, because if we approach this just as a national issue, what's going on in the United States, it's certainly influencing and bleeding into the German Twitter sphere, and that will continue to happen if we look at other national contexts as well. So I think that the German framework does, I think, offer some interesting opportunities, but I would really hope that we think about this on a kind of platform-wide context as well.
Right. And what role do conspiracies play in far-right ecosystems? And how do does the family, the state, and the COVID pandemic fit into these ecosystems?
So conspiracy theories were a key part of sort of tracing the information transmission of these networks. And over the course of this project, the COVID-19 pandemic occurred. And so seeing the way in which far-right communities took the pandemic and discussions about public health restrictions, for example, to then latch on to these, contemporary events and frame them using Islamophobic, language, hashtags, I think really shows the way in which far-right communities are adept at, working with, contemporary events or crises and operationalizing them for their own messaging purposes. But we can also look at sort of more traditional conspiracy theories related to stories about violence targeting European or white American women, really targeting Muslim communities, Muslim men in particular, as these, you know, threats to the ethnic German nation or the white American nation. This is also something we saw. So even though, you know, we have these kind of new evolving communicative conditions around the pandemic, that far right groups really continue to go back to these historic forms of, you know, Orientalist racist rhetoric targeting Muslim communities that often have a very gender dimension, in addition to also presenting Muslim women and images of women wearing the hijab as, you know, threatening images to incite or radicalize other users online, that this is something we're seeing. You know, we can look back hundreds of years and look at this similar type of Orientalist rhetoric, but now it's being updated, you know, to the digital context and the transmission of some of these conspiracy theories and language is just, it's an increased speed and it's reaching a far larger audience. And this all goes to play into these conspiracy theories, which suggest this imagined Islamicization of the state, that Muslim communities are not the only groups that these coalitions target, that whether it is, you know, the progressive left, the Greens in Germany, the progressive left in the United States, that these far-right networks target other coalitions, often, you know, political state actors, as imagined as in collusion with Muslim communities. And it is, it's a kind of complex worldview to deconstruct. And, you know, we may see this and say, that's obviously outlandish. But that's sort of how this radicalization works, is that if you buy into one aspect of this ideology, then these other aspects become easier to accept as well. And so one area of concern I have as well is that this anti-Muslim hate speech is not just about targeting Muslim communities. This also implicates, the targeting of progressive coalitions, of feminist groups, of Jewish communities, that all of these radical, ideologies, extremist ideologies, are looking really to target and demonize a variety of groups. And so I think that's something also that we have to kind of consider when we look at conspiracy theories. It might ostensibly be about one community, but it really is tapping into a larger, more extreme conspiratorial worldview.
All right. And you touched on this before, but we're coming up to the end of our time together. And I wanted to just give you a chance to talk a little bit about what you see as the appropriate response to this avalanche of digital hate.
I think this is a really hard question to address, but I would say, mentioning the German policy framework, I think that that's one area that we could really think about. There is a lot of discussion, certainly in the United States right now, about technology regulation, and some of that is a bit fraught, thinking about TikTok. There's some interesting cases coming up to the Supreme Court, and I think that there's really an imperative for us to think through some political solutions to hate speech, to misinformation, and user privacy, and to regulate the way in which these companies operate. Policy regulation, I think that that's one area. But I also, looking at the European Union, the Digital Services Act, looking at financial penalties, force, these companies to comply with certain standards is one option. But I would say that I'm most interested and maybe excited by citizen activism and advocacy, whether that is through campaigns, boycotts, or other types of political pressure led by citizens to make our digital spaces safer. And I think that that is perhaps the most exciting For me, while I'm really concerned about the level of hate speech and this extremist content, I'm not totally sure that, you know, regulation from Congress would really address the problem fully on its own. And so I think that, we can be creative and maybe think through, how to engage in digital spaces and maybe move off platform, start our, different digital communities, seeing the uptake of Blue Sky, one of the Twitter alternatives, I think is interesting to think about, is if we as consumers and citizens choose to pull back from some of these legacy social media platforms, can maybe we create digital communities that are safer and more inclusive on our own?
Right. I was going to ask you about this move to kind of pull back from some of these platforms like Twitter. I remember when Elon Musk was first discussed that he was going to purchase Twitter. And then I guess, especially once he did, then some people, I saw in my social media, some people were saying, okay, that's it. We're going to leave Twitter and Twitter is going to sink into the ground or whatever. But, and obviously I don't follow these things nearly as closely as you do, but my sense is that that has not come to fruition. So I'm curious, on your thoughts of, just how efficacious such a effort is or could be.
Absolutely. I will say I'm still on Twitter or X, but I'm also on Blue Sky now. I think that we're actually at a really interesting kind of inflection point with some of these platforms that looking back, I think particularly to social movements like hashtag MeToo, the Arab Spring, BLM, these were really watershed.
Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter movement that were really happening in a digital space on Twitter. And Twitter is really not, it's not the only public sphere in town anymore. And I think that that is, offers some interesting opportunities for more kind of targeted community that we might want to build in more, safer, more walled spaces. But it also means, that there's less of that, one public sphere. And that's also to say that Twitter was just a fraction as well of, other online conversation. But I think what we're seeing is kind of a fragmentation away from these legacy platforms that now folks are, not everyone is on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And now we're seeing, communities being built on Blue Sky or, in Telegram. We're seeing the rise of the group chat as a place where political conversations are happening moving to TikTok. And I think that can be good, but as a researcher, that concern me because suddenly we have all of these different spaces where, it can be difficult to get a sense of what type of information are people consuming? What type of language are people using? I can't peer into everyone's group chat to get a sense of, some of these trends. And so that's something that I think about as a concern is if we're all kind of retreating into our own enclaves and different platforms, more private spaces is, how do we get a sense as researchers, as scholars, as policymakers of the way in which people are engaging and communicating online? But I think that can be good because I certainly understand not wanting to be in such a toxic, hate-filled space and to retreating to a more, a walled area.
Right. And I'm just curious about this effort to withdraw, to step away from some of these, deeply toxic spaces. I'm curious, is there a concern that if, let's say, the more moderate, reasonable people leave these platforms and these spaces, assuming that these platforms don't completely, implode as a result, does that cause those spaces themselves to become even more toxic because now they're essentially, truly just an echo chamber of, very far-right voices, and there's no one there to kind of present or insert some notes of caution or concern or, you know, reasonableness or whatever.
I think that is exactly a huge issue. And I would say Twitter is, I think, a good example of what happens when we sort of turn the dial, you know, to more of this extremist content and change policies to allow this type of speech, is that Twitter is a platform. It has been an amazing tool for progressive digital activists, and looking at the case of India in particular, the sort of anti-CIA or CIA NRC coalition led by a group called the Women of Shaheen Bagh and associated Indian feminist activists online, that was really platformed on Twitter and also Instagram, that progressive response to Prime Minister Modi's policies. And that was in direct opposition to then the pro-CIA NRC movement. But it becomes difficult, I think, to engage in progressive coalition building and even just community building of, you know, like-minded, you know, coalitions when these platforms then become so difficult to navigate, you know, when there's so much more harassment and when the type of extremist content is increasingly sort of uplifted by, you know, the platform's algorithm, that it makes it very difficult, I think, to engage in these spaces as a moderate, everyday kind of average user, or as a progressive activist who wants to engage in these spaces to drive the political conversation in a different way. So that is certainly something, you know, that is a concern of mine. But, you know, I would not fault anyone for, you know, for leaving a digital space or a platform that no longer serves them, because these are, this may be digital speech, but I think this really results in real tangible, real world harms too. You know, I am hopeful that maybe some of these alternative networks, you know, might offer spaces for community building, but also to not, you know, fully maybe give up the fight and kind of retreating completely.
Right. All right. Well, last question. All right. There's so much more to talk about, but last question. I'm really curious, as a feminist, as someone who's very concerned about progressive politics and so on, I'm curious just about your kind of personal experience writing this book and you know, spending, I don't know, countless hours reading really hateful messages and discourses. Like, how did you deal with that? How did you, you know, think of that on a personal level, just wading through all of this hate speech in order to be able to properly document it?
Certainly. I would say on one level, I find this type of content almost like watching a car accident, where it's so horrifying and it's so disturbing, but I can't look away. And I'm really motivated to understand how this operates, hopefully so it can be stopped. But on another level, I would really classify myself as an intersectional feminist. And so I think that if, you know, you're aligned with that, ideological project of inclusivity and intersectional feminism, I think as a researcher, I felt as though I have an obligation to take part in the research of some of this content, that it's my responsibility, if I do want digital spaces to be safer, to really engage in this type of work, you know, to make them safer, particularly for, you know, for my colleagues, compatriots, who are also part of this project. So I do think that, you know, as an intersectional feminist researcher, I have an obligation to look at this content, because it is, it's incredibly distressing, and horrifying, you know, and as a as a researcher who is white, I really want to push back against white supremacy and white Christian nationalism, and hopefully to offer, you know, a detailed documentation of this movement, so that we can do something about it, whether that is through policy, through additional research, and through really thinking about how we can disrupt maybe some of these foundational, you know, causes of racialized nationalism in the United States and across the world.
Well, that's a great answer. thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely to talk with you today and to be part of the network.
Terrific. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.